Chapter 35. Crane Chemical's first quarter earnings were much better than expected. In fact, they astounded the analysts who had been expecting about $1.25 per share on the high end. When Crane reported $2.05 per share, the company and its amazing comeback attracted even more interest from financial publications. All 14 plants were running at full throttle. Prices had been cut to recapture market share. The sales force was working overtime to fill orders. Debt had been slashed. Most of the problems that had dogged the company throughout the preceding year were suddenly gone. The stock had made a steady and impressive climb from single digits and was trading around $24 when the earnings news hit. It jumped to $30. When last seen at that price, the stock was free-falling the day after the verdict in Hattiesburg. The Trudeau Group now owned 80% of Crane, or around 48 million shares. Since the rumors of bankruptcy just before the election back in November, Mr. Trudeau's net worth had increased by $800 million, and he was quite anxious to double that. Before a final decision is handed down by the Supreme Court, the justices spend weeks reading one another's memos and preliminary opinions. They sometimes argue privately. They lobby for votes to support their positions. They lean on their clerks for useful gossip from down the hall. Occasionally, there are deadlocks that take months to resolve. The last thing Justice Fisk read late Friday afternoon was McIlwain's dissent in the case of Jeanette Baker versus Crane Chemical Corporation. It was widely assumed to be a dissent with three others concurring. The majority opinion was written by Justice Callaghan. Romano was working on a concurring opinion, and there was a chance that Albritton would write a dissent of his own. Though the details were not complete, there was little doubt that the final decision would be a 5-4 reversal of the verdict. Fisk read the dissent, scoffed at it, and decided to concur with Callaghan first thing Monday morning. Then Justice Fisk changed clothes and became Coach Fisk. It was time for a game. The Rockies opened their season with a weekend jamboree in the Delta town of Rustburg, an hour northwest of Jackson. They would play one game on Friday night, at least two on Saturday, and maybe one on Sunday. The games were only four innings long, and every player was encouraged to pitch and play different positions. There were no trophies and no championships, just a loosely competitive round-robin to start the season. 30 teams signed up in the 11- and 12-year-old division, including two others from Brookhaven. The Rockies' first opponent was a team from the small town of Rolling Fork. The night was cool, the air clear, the sports complex filled with players and parents, and the excitement of five games going at once. Doreen was in Brookhaven with Clarissa and Zeke, who had a game at 9 on Saturday morning. In the first inning, Josh played second base, and when he came to bat, his father was coaching at third. When he struck out on four pitches, his father yelled encouragement and reminded him that he could not hit the ball if he kept the bat on his shoulder. In the second inning, Josh went to the mound and promptly struck out the first two batters he faced. The third hitter was a stocky 12-year-old, the catcher batting in the 7-hole. He yanked the first pitch foul, but very hard. "Keep it low and away," Ron yelled from the dugout. The second pitch was not low and away. It was a fastball right down the middle of the plate, and the hitter ripped it hard. The ball shot off the barrel of the aluminum bat and left the plate much faster than it had arrived. For a split second, Josh was frozen, and by the time he began to react, the ball was in his face. He jerked just slightly as the ball hit him square in the right temple. The ball then careened over the shortstop and rolled into left field. Josh's eyes were open when his father reached him. He was lying in a heap at the base of the mound, stunned and groaning. "Say something, Josh," Ron said as he gently touched the wound. "Where's the ball?" Josh asked. Don't worry about it. Can you see me all right?
I think so.
Tears were leaking from his eyes, and he clenched his teeth to keep from crying. The skin had been scraped, and there was a little blood in his hair. The swelling had already started.
Get some ice, someone said. Call the EMTs.
The other coaches and umpires hovered around. The kid who hit the line drive stood nearby, ready to cry himself.
Don't close your eyes, Ron said.
Okay,
Josh said, still breathing rapidly.
Who plays third base for the Braves?
Chipper.
And center field?
Andrew.
Attaboy.
After a few minutes, Josh sat up and the fans applauded. Then he stood and walked with his father's help to the dugout, where he stretched out on the bench. Ron, his heart still hammering away, gently placed a bag of ice on the knot on Josh's temple. The game slowly picked up again. A medic arrived and examined Josh, who seemed perfectly responsive. He could see, hear, remember details, and even mentioned returning to the game. The medic said no, as did Coach Fisk.
Maybe tomorrow,
Ron said, but only to comfort his son. Ron had a knot of his own stuck firmly in his throat, and he was just beginning to calm down. He planned to take him home after the game.
He looks fine, the medic said, but you might want to get him x-rayed.
Now? Ron asked.
No rush, but I'd do it tonight.
By the end of the third inning, Josh was sitting up and joking with his teammates. Ron returned to the third base coach's box and was whispering to a runner when one of the Rockies yelled from the dugout,
Josh is throwing up!
The umpire stopped the game again, and the coaches cleared the Rockies' dugout. Josh was dizzy, sweating profusely, and violently nauseous. The medic was nearby, and within minutes a stretcher arrived with two emergency medical technicians. Ron held his son's hand as they rolled him to the parking lot.
Don't close your eyes, Ron said over and over.
And talk to me, Josh.
My head hurts, Dad.
You're okay, just don't close your eyes.
They lifted the stretcher into the ambulance, locked it down, and allowed Ron to squat beside his son. 5 minutes later, they wheeled him into the emergency room entrance at Henry County General Hospital. Josh was alert and had not vomited since leaving the ballpark. A three-car smash-up had occurred an hour earlier, and the emergency room was in a frenzy. The first doctor to examine Josh ordered a CT scan and explained to Ron that he would not be allowed to go farther into the hospital.
I think he's fine, the doctor said,
and Ron found a chair in the cluttered waiting room. He called Doreen and managed to get through that difficult conversation. Time virtually stopped as the minutes dragged on. The Rockies' head coach, Ron's former law partner, arrived in a rush and coaxed Ron outside. He had something to show him. From the back seat of his car, he produced an aluminum bat.
This is it, he said gravely.
It was a Screamer, a popular bat manufactured by Wainwright Sporting Goods, one of a dozen to be found in any ballpark in the country.
Look at this, the coach said, rubbing the barrel where someone had tried to sand off part of the label. It's a -7, outlawed years ago.
-7 referred to the differential between the weight and the length of the bat. It was 29 inches long, but weighed only 22 ounces, much easier to swing without yielding any of the force upon contact with the ball. Current rules prohibited a differential greater than 4. The bat was at least 5 years old. Ron gawked at it as if it were a smoking gun.
How'd you get it?
I checked it when the kid came to the plate again. I showed it to the ump, who threw it out and went after the coach. I went after him, too, but to be honest, he didn't have a clue. He gave me the damn thing.
More of the Rockies' parents arrived, then some of the players. They huddled around a bench near the emergency exit and waited. An hour passed before the doctor returned to brief Ron.
CT scan's negative, the doctor said. I think he's okay, just a mild concussion.
Thank God.
Where do you live?
Brookhaven.
You can take him home, but he needs to be very still for the next few days. No sports of any kind. If he experiences dizziness, headaches, double vision, blurred vision, dilated pupils, ringing in his ears, bad taste in his mouth, moodiness, or drowsiness, then you get him to your local doctor.
Ron nodded and wanted to take notes. I'll put all this in a discharge report, along with the CT scan.
Fine, sure.
The doctor paused, looked at Ron a bit closer, then said,
What do you do for a living?
I'm a judge, Supreme Court. The doctor smiled, offered a hand to shake.
I sent you a check last year. Thank you for what you're doing down there.
Thanks, Doc. An hour later, 10 minutes before midnight, they left Rustburg. Josh sat in the front seat with an ice pack stuck to his head and listened to the Braves-Dodgers game on the radio. Ron glanced at him every 10 seconds, ready to pounce on the first warning sign. There were none until they entered the outskirts of Brookhaven, and Josh said,
Dad, my head hurts a little.
The nurse said a small headache is okay, but a bad one means trouble. On a scale of 1 to 10, where is it?
3.
Okay. When it gets to 5, I want to know.
Doreen was waiting at the door with a dozen questions. She read the discharge summary at the kitchen table while Ron and Josh ate a sandwich. After 2 bites, Josh said he was not hungry. He had been starving when they left Rustburg. He was suddenly irritable, but it was hours past his bedtime. When Doreen began her version of a physical exam, he barked at her and went to use the bathroom.
What do you think? Ron asked.
He appears to be fine, she replied, just a little cranky and sleepy.
They had a huge fight over the sleeping arrangements. Josh was 11 years old and wasn't about to sleep with his mother. Ron explained to him rather firmly that on this particular night and under these unusual circumstances, he would indeed go to sleep with his mother at his side. Ron would be napping in a chair next to the bed. Under the steady gaze of both parents, he fell asleep quickly. Then Ron nodded off in the chair, and at some point, around 3:30 a.m., Doreen finally closed her eyes. She opened them an hour later when Josh screamed. He had vomited again, and his head was splitting. He was dizzy, incoherent, and crying, and said everything looked blurry. The family doctor was a close friend named Calvin Treat. Ron called him while Doreen ran next door to fetch a neighbor. In less than 10 minutes, they were walking into the ER at the Brookhaven Hospital. Ron was carrying Josh, and Doreen had the discharge papers and the CT scan. The ER physician did a quick exam, and everything was wrong. Slow heart rate, unequal pupils, drowsiness. Dr. Treat arrived and took over while the ER physician examined the discharge summary.
Who read the scan? Treat asked.
The doctor in Rustburg, Ron said.
When?
About 8 o'clock last night.
8 hours ago?
Something like that.
It doesn't show much, he said. Let's do a scan here.
The ER doctor and a nurse took Josh to an exam room. Treat said to the Fisks,
You need to wait out there. I'll be right back.
They sleepwalked to the ER waiting room, too numb and too terrified to say anything for a few moments. The room was empty, but gave the impression of having survived a rough night. Empty soda cans, newspapers on the floor, candy wrappers on the tables. How many others had sat here in a daze, waiting for the doctors to appear and deliver bad news? They held hands and prayed for a long time, silently at first, then back and forth in short, soft sentences. And when the praying was over, they felt some relief. Doreen called home, talked to the neighbor who was babysitting, and promised to call again when they knew something. When Calvin Treat walked into the room, they knew things were not going well. He sat down and faced them.
Josh has a fracture of the skull according to our CT scan. The scan you brought from Rustburg is not very helpful because it belongs to another patient.
What the hell?
Ron said. The doctor there looked at the wrong CT scan. The patient's name is barely readable at the bottom, but it ain't Josh Fisk.
This can't be true, Doreen said.
It is, but we'll worry about it later.
Listen carefully. Here's where we are. The ball hit Josh right here.
he said, pointing to his right temple. It's the thinnest part of the skull, known as the temporal bone. The crack is called a linear fracture, and it's about 2 inches long. Just inside the skull is a membrane that encases the brain, and feeding it is the middle meningeal artery. This artery goes through the bone, and when the bone was cracked, the artery was lacerated, causing blood to accumulate between the bone and the membrane. This compressed the brain. The blood clot, known as an epidural hematoma, grew and increased the pressure inside the skull. The only treatment now is a craniotomy, which is a removal of the hematoma by opening the brain.
Oh, my God, Doreen said and covered her eyes.
Please listen, Treat went on. We need to get him to Jackson to the trauma unit at University Medical Center. I suggest we call their air ambulance and get him there in a helicopter.
The ER physician arrived in a hurry and said to Dr. Treat, the patient is deteriorating. You need to take a look. As Dr. Treat started to walk away, Ron stood, grabbed his arm, and said, talk to me, Calvin. How serious is this?
It's very serious, Ron. It could be life-threatening.
Josh was boarded onto the helicopter and whisked away. Doreen and Calvin Treat rode with him while Ron raced home, checked on Zeke and Clarissa, and threw a few necessities in an overnight bag. Then he sped north on Interstate 55, driving 100 miles per hour and daring any cop to stop him. When he wasn't plea bargaining with God, he was cursing the doctor in Russburg who studied the wrong CT scan. And occasionally, he turned around and glanced at the defectively designed and unreasonably dangerous product in the rear seat. He had never liked aluminum bats. Chapter 36. At 8:10 on Saturday morning, some 13 hours after being struck by the baseball, Josh underwent surgery at the University of Mississippi Medical Center in Jackson. Ron and Doreen waited in the hospital's chapel with friends who were arriving from Brookhaven. Their pastor was with them. Back at St. Luke's, a prayer vigil was underway in the church's sanctuary. Ron's brother arrived at noon with Zeke and Clarissa, both as frightened and shell-shocked as their parents. Hours passed with no word from the surgeons. Dr. Treat disappeared from time to time to check on things, but seldom brought back any useful news. As some of their friends left, others came to replace them. Grandparents and uncles and aunts and cousins arrived and waited and prayed, and then left to roam around the sprawling hospital. 4 hours after the Fisks last saw their son, the chief surgeon appeared and motioned for them to follow him. Dr. Treat joined the conversation as they walked down a hallway away from the crowd. They stopped near a door to a restroom. Ron and Doreen clutched each other, bracing for the worst. The surgeon spoke in a grave and weary voice.
He has survived the surgery and is doing as well as can be expected. We removed a large hematoma compressing the brain. The pressure inside the skull has been reduced, but there was a lot of brain swelling. An extraordinary amount, to be honest. There will likely be some permanent damage.
Life and death are easily understood, but damage conveys fears that are not readily defined.
He's not going to die, Doreen said.
As of right now, he's alive and his vital signs are good. He has a 90% chance of survival. The next 72 hours will be crucial.
How much damage? Ron asked, getting to the point.
There's no way to tell right now. Some of the damage might be reversible with time and therapy, but that's really a conversation for another day. Right now, let's just continue to pray that he improves over the next 3 days.
Late Saturday night, Josh was in the ICU. Ron and Doreen were allowed to see him for 10 minutes, though he was in a drug-induced coma. They didn't manage to maintain their composure when they first saw him. His head was wrapped like a mummy, and a breathing tube ran from his mouth. He was hooked to a ventilator. Doreen was afraid to touch any part of his body, even his foot. A sympathetic nurse agreed to move a chair to a spot outside his room and allow one parent to sit there throughout the night. Ron and Doreen sent their support team back to Brookhaven, then began alternating between the ICU and the waiting room. Sleep was out of the question, and they walked the halls until sunrise Sunday morning. The doctors were pleased with Josh's first night. After an early morning review, Ron and Doreen found a motel nearby. They showered and managed a quick nap before reassuming their positions at the hospital. The waiting rituals began again, as did the prayer vigils at home. The flow of visitors coming and going soon became an ordeal in itself. Ron and Doreen just wanted to be alone in the room with their son. Late Sunday night, when Doreen was in the ICU and the crowd had left, Ron strolled the corridors of the hospital, stretching his legs and trying to stay awake. He found another waiting room, one for the families of non-critical patients. It was much more inviting, with nicer furniture and a wider selection of vending machines. Dinner was a diet soda and a bag of pretzels, and as he crunched on them mindlessly, a small boy walked by and seemed ready to touch his knee. "Aaron," his mother barked from across the room, "come here." "He's fine," Ron said, smiling at the child, who quickly drifted away. Aaron. The name brought back a memory. Aaron was the boy struck in the head by the piece of metal thrown by the bush hog. A brain injury, permanent disability, financial ruin for the family. The jury found the manufacturer liable. The trial had a clean record. At that moment, Justice Fisk could not remember why he had so easily voted with the majority in reversing the verdict. Back then, barely 2 months ago, he had never felt the pain of a parent with a severely injured child, or the fear of losing the child. Now, in the middle of this nightmare, he remembered Aaron in a different way. When he read the medical summaries in the case, he had done so in the comfort of his office, far removed from reality. The kid was severely injured, which was a pity, but accidents happen in everyday life. Could the accident have been prevented? He thought so then, and he certainly thought so now. Little Aaron was back, staring at the bag of pretzels. It was shaking. "Aaron, leave that man alone," the mother yelled. Ron stared at the shaking pretzels. The accident could have been prevented and should have been. If the manufacturer had followed established regulations, then the bush hog would have been much safer. Why had he been so eager to protect its manufacturer? The case was gone. Forever dismissed by five supposedly wise men, none of whom had ever shown much sympathy for those who suffer. He had to wonder if the other four, Callaghan, Romano, Bateman, and Ross, had ever roamed the tomb-like halls of a hospital at all hours of the day and night, waiting for a child to live or die. No, they had not. Otherwise, they wouldn't be what they are today. Sunday slowly yielded to Monday. Another week began, though it was far different from any one before. Ron and Doreen refused to leave the hospital for more than an hour or two. Josh was not responding well, and they were afraid that each visit to his bed might be their last glimpse of him alive. Friends brought clothes and food and newspapers, and they offered to sit and wait if the Fisks would like to go home for a few hours. But Ron and Doreen stood fast and plowed on with a fixed determination, zombie-like in their belief that Josh would do better if they stayed close by. Tired and haggard, they lost patience with the parade of visitors from home and began to hide in various places around the hospital. Ron called his office and told his secretary he had no idea when he might return. Doreen told her boss she was taking a leave of absence. When the boss explained delicately that their policies did not grant such leaves, she politely informed him it was time to change said policies. He agreed to do so immediately. The hospital was 15 minutes from the Garten building, and early Tuesday, Ron stopped by for a quick look at his desk. It had accumulated several piles of paperwork. His chief clerk ran down the list of all pending cases, but Ron was distracted. "I'm thinking about a leave of absence. Run it by the chief," he instructed the clerk. "For 30 days, maybe 60. I can't concentrate on this stuff right now."
"Sure, will do. You were planning to concur this morning on Baker versus Crane?"
"It can wait. Everything can wait." He managed to leave the building without seeing another member of the court. Tuesday's edition of the Clarion Ledger ran a story about Josh and his injury. Justice Fisk could not be reached for comment, but an unidentified source got most of the facts right. The doctors had removed a large blood clot that had been pressing on his brain. His life was no longer in danger. It was too soon to speculate about long-term problems. There was no mention of the doctor who read the wrong CT scan. However, the online chatter soon filled in the gaps. There was gossip about an illegal baseball bat involved in the accident and speculation about severe brain damage and an account from someone inside the Henry County General Hospital who claimed to know that the doctors there had screwed up. There were a couple of wild theories that Justice Fisk had undergone a dramatic conversion in his judicial philosophy. One rumor declared that he was about to resign. Wes Payton watched it carefully from his office. His wife did not. She was working hard to distract herself with other cases, but Wes was consumed with the story about Josh. As the father of young children, he could not imagine the horror the Fisks were enduring, and he could not avoid wondering how the tragedy might affect the Baker case. He did not expect a sudden about-face by Ron Fisk, but the possibility was there. They had only one prayer left, and that was for a miracle. Could this be it? They waited. The decision was due any day now. By early Tuesday afternoon, Josh was beginning to show signs of improvement. He was awake, alert, and following commands. He couldn't talk because of the breathing tube, but he seemed fidgety, which was a good sign. The pressure on his brain had been reduced to almost normal levels. The doctors had explained several times that it would take days, maybe weeks, to determine a long-term prognosis. With Josh awake, the Fisks decided to spend the night at home. This was greatly encouraged by the doctors and nurses. Doreen's sister agreed to sit in the ICU, within 15 feet of her nephew's bed. They left Jackson, relieved to be away from the hospital and anxious to see Zeke and Clarissa. Their conversation was about home-cooked food, long showers, and their comfortable bed. They vowed to savor the next 10 hours because their ordeal was just beginning. But it would be difficult to relax. On the outskirts of Jackson, Ron's cell phone rang. It was Justice Callaghan, and he began the conversation with a long-winded inquiry into Josh's condition. He conveyed condolences from everyone at the court. He promised to stop by the hospital as soon as possible. Ron was thankful, but soon had the feeling there was a business angle to the call.
"Just a couple of matters, Ron," Callaghan said, "and I know you're preoccupied right now."
"I am indeed."
"There's nothing terribly urgent here, except for two cases. It looks as though that Bowmore toxic case is split 4-4. No surprise there, I guess. I was hoping you would concur with me on this one."
"I thought Romano was writing, too."
"He is, and he's finished, as is all Britain. All opinions are ready, and we need your concurrence."
"Let me sleep on it."
"Fine. The other is that nursing home case out of Webster County. Another 4-4 split."
"That's a very ugly case," Ron said, almost in disgust. In yet another nursing home case, a patient was basically abandoned by the staff and eventually found unfed, lying in his own waste, covered in bed sores, unmedicated, and delirious. The company that owned the facility had reported huge profits, which came as a surprise to the jury when it was proven just how little was spent on patient care. Nursing home abuse was so rampant, Ron was already sick of reading about it.
"Yes, it is. Very tragic," Callaghan said, as if he were capable of sympathy.
"And I guess you want to reverse."
"I don't see the liability, and the damages are exorbitant."
In the 3.5 months Ron had been on the court, Justice Callaghan had never managed to see liability in any death or injury case. He believed jurors were stupid and easily led astray by slick trial lawyers, and he believed that it was his solemn responsibility to correct every miscarriage of justice, plaintiff's verdict, from the comfort of his detached environment.
"Let me sleep on it," Ron said again.
Doreen was becoming irritated with the phone call.
"Yes, always a good idea. If we could finish these two cases, Ron, then a short leave of absence might work."
A short leave of absence, or a long one for that matter, was solely within the discretion of each justice. Ron did not need Callaghan to approve it. He thanked him anyway and hung up. The Fisk's kitchen was filled with food from friends, mainly cakes and pies and casseroles. A buffet was arranged on one counter, and they ate with Zeke, Clarissa, two neighbors, and Doreen's parents. They slept 6 hours, then drove back to the hospital. When they arrived, Josh was in the midst of a prolonged seizure, the second in the past hour. It passed, and his vital signs improved, but it was a setback in his slow recovery. Thursday morning, he was alert again, but irritable, restless, unable to concentrate, unable to remember anything about the accident, and highly agitated. One of the doctors explained that his condition was symptomatic of post-concussion syndrome. Thursday night, the Rockies coach, Ron's former law partner, drove to Jackson for another visit. He and Ron had dinner in the hospital canteen, and over soup and salad, he pulled out his notes.
"I've done some research," the coach said. "Wainwright stopped making the lighter bat 6 years ago, probably in response to complaints about injuries. In fact, the entire industry went to -4 and nothing higher. Over the years, the aluminum alloys got lighter, but also stronger. The barrel of the bat wall actually absorbs the ball upon contact, then launches it when the wall pops back into its original position. The result is a lighter bat, but also a much more dangerous one. Safety advocates have been bitching about these bats for a decade, and lots of studies have been done. In one test, a pitching machine threw a fastball at 90 miles an hour, and the ball came off the bat at 120. Two fatalities on record, one in high school, one in college, but hundreds of injuries in all age groups. So Little League and some of the other youth organizations got together and banned anything above a -4. But the problem is obvious. Wainwright and the other bat makers have a million of the old bats still out there, still being used, and we finally saw one in the game last Friday."
"There was never a recall?" Ron asked.
"None whatsoever. And they know the damn things are dangerous. Their own tests prove it."
Ron was nibbling on a saltine, certain of where this was going, and unwilling to help it get there.
"The Rolling Fork team is probably liable, but it's not worth the trouble. The city of Rustburg could be held liable because the umpire, a city employee, by the way, failed to check the equipment. And the big tuna is, of course, Wainwright. Assets of $2 billion, tons of insurance coverage, very good case of liability. Damages undetermined but substantial. All in all, a strong case, except for one small problem. Our Supreme Court."
"You sound like a trial lawyer."
"They're not always wrong. If you ask me, I say you should consider filing a product case."
"I don't recall asking you, and I can't file a lawsuit. I'd be laughed out of the state."
"What about the next kid, Ron? What about the next family that will go through the same nightmare?
Litigation has cleaned up a lot of bad products and protected a lot of people. There's no way. And why should you and the state of Mississippi get stuck with $1 million in medical bills? Wainwright is worth billions. They made a lousy product. Make them pay. You are a trial lawyer. No, I'm your former partner. We practiced together for 14 years, and the Ron Fisk I remember had great respect for the law. Justice Fisk seems determined to change all of it. Okay, I've heard enough. I'm sorry, Ron. I shouldn't have. It's okay. Let's go check on Josh.
Tony Zachary returned to Jackson on Friday and heard the news about Josh Fisk. He went straight to the hospital and eventually found Ron napping on a waiting room sofa. They talked for an hour about the accident, about the surgery, and also about Tony's fishing expedition down in Belize. Tony was deeply concerned about young Josh. He certainly hoped the child would make a quick and complete recovery. But what he wanted to know, but couldn't bring himself to ask, was, when might you finish up with the Crane appeal? As soon as he was in his car, he called Barry Reinhardt with the disturbing news. A week after he arrived at the hospital, Josh was moved from the ICU to a private room, one that was immediately inundated with flowers, stuffed animals, cards from his fifth-grade classmates, balloons, and enough candy to feed an entire elementary school. A cot was arranged so that one of his parents could sleep next to his bed. While the room at first gave the impression of a lighter mood, things turned gloomy almost immediately. The team of neurologists began extensive evaluations. There was no paralysis, but a definite decline in motor skills and coordination, along with severe memory loss and an inability to concentrate. Josh was easily distracted and slow to recognize objects. The tubes were gone, but his speech was noticeably slower. Some recovery was likely in the months to come, but there was a good chance of permanent damage. The thick head bandages were replaced with much smaller ones. Josh was allowed to walk to the restroom, a heartbreaking sight, as he shuffled awkwardly forward, one clumsy step after another. Ron helped him and fought back tears. His little baseball star had played his final game. Chapter 37. Dr. Calvin Treat drove to Rustburg and arranged a meeting with the ER physician who had read the wrong CT scan. After they examined the two scans, Josh's and the other patients, they argued briefly before the doctor admitted that the emergency room that night had been chaotic and understaffed, and yes, mistakes were made. The fact that he had botched the treatment of the son of a Supreme Court justice was overwhelming. "Will the family file suit?" he asked, clearly shaken. "I don't know, but you should notify your insurance company." Treat took the file to Jackson and discussed it with Ron and Doreen. He walked them through standard CT scan procedure, then recounted his conversation with the ER doctor. "What should have been done?" Doreen asked. Treat knew the question was coming. He knew he would be asked by his friends to pass judgment on the performance of another doctor. He had decided days ago to be as honest as possible. "They should have brought him here immediately and removed the blood clot. It's brain surgery, but it's not a complicated procedure. Josh would have been home 2 days after the surgery, completely healed with no damage whatsoever." "This CT scan was taken at 8 o'clock Friday night," Ron said. "You saw Josh in Brookhaven about 8 hours later, right?"
"Something like that."
"So for 8 hours, the pressure continued to build inside his skull?"
"Yes."
"And the compression of the brain by the blood clot damages the brain?"
"Yes."
There was a long silence as they danced around the obvious conclusion. Ron finally asked, "Calvin, what would you do if it were your kid?"
"Sue the bastard. It's gross negligence."
"I can't sue, Calvin. I'd make a mockery out of myself."
After a game of squash, a shower, and a massage in the Senate gym, Myers Rudd ducked into a limo and suffered through the late afternoon traffic like everyone else. An hour later, he arrived at the General Aviation Terminal at Dulles, and there he boarded a Gulfstream V, the newest in the fleet owned by Mr. Carl Trudeau. The senator did not know who owned the jet, nor had he ever met Mr. Trudeau, which in most cultures would seem odd since Rudd had taken so much money from the man. But in Washington, money arrives through a myriad of strange and nebulous conduits. Often those taking it have only a vague idea of where it's coming from. Often they have no clue. In most democracies, the transference of so much cash would be considered outright corruption. But in Washington, the corruption has been legalized. Senator Rudd didn't know and didn't care that he was owned by other people. He had over $11 million in the bank, money he could eventually keep if not forced to waste it on some frivolous campaign. In return for such an investment, Rudd had a perfect voting record on all matters dealing with pharmaceuticals, chemicals, oil, energy, insurance, banks, and on and on. But he was a man of the people. He traveled alone on this night. The two flight attendants served him cocktails, lobster, and wine, and the meal was hardly over when the Gulfstream began its descent into Jackson International. Another limo was waiting, and 20 minutes after landing, the senator was dropped off at a side entrance of the University Medical Center. In a room on the third floor, he found Ron and Doreen staring blankly at a television while their son slept. "How's the boy?" he asked with great warmth as they scrambled to get to their feet and look somewhat presentable. They were stunned to see the great man himself suddenly appearing from nowhere at 9:30 on a Tuesday night. Doreen couldn't find her shoes. They chatted softly about Josh and his progress. The senator claimed to be in town on business, just passing through on his way back to Washington, but he had heard the news and felt compelled to drop in for a quick hello. They were touched by his presence. In fact, they were rattled and found it hard to believe. A nurse broke things up and declared it was time to turn off the lights. The senator hugged Doreen, pecked her cheek, squeezed her hands, promised to do anything within his power to help, then left the room with Ron, who was startled to see no signs of an entourage hovering in the hallway. Not a single staffer, gopher, bodyguard, driver. No one. The senator had come to visit all by himself. The gesture meant even more to Ron. As they walked down the hall, Rudd offered the same quick howdy and the same plastic grin to everyone they passed. These were his people, and he knew that they adored him. He was blathering on about some mundane fight in Congress, and Ron was trying to appear captivated while suddenly wishing the man would just wrap things up and leave. At the exit doors, Rudd wished him well, promised to pray for the family, and extended offers to help on any front. As they shook hands, the senator, almost as an afterthought, said, "By the way, Judge, it'd be nice to finish that Crane appeal." Ron's hand went limp, and his jaw dropped. He tried to think of a response. As he treaded water, the senator gave his parting shot. "I know you'll do the right thing. These verdicts are killing our state." Rudd grabbed his shoulder, blessed him with another plastic grin, then walked through the doors and disappeared. Back in the limo, Rudd ordered the driver to the suburbs north of town. There he would spend the night with his Jackson mistress, then hustle back to D.C. on the Gulfstream early in the morning. Ron lay on the cot and tried to settle himself in for another long night. Josh's sleep patterns had become so erratic that every night was a new adventure. When the nurse made the rounds at midnight, both father and son were wide awake. Doreen, thankfully, was at the motel fast asleep, thanks to the little green pills the nurses were sneaking to them. Ron took another one, and the nurse gave Josh his own sedative. In the awful darkness of the room, Ron grappled with the visit by Senator Rudd. Was it a simple matter of an arrogant politician stepping over the line to help a big donor? Rudd relentlessly took money from anyone who wanted to hand it out legally, so it would be no surprise if he had taken a bundle from Crane. Or was it more complicated than that? Crane had not contributed one dime to the Fisk campaign. Ron had combed through the records after the election when he, too, had been shocked at the cash raised and spent. He had argued and fought with Tony Zachary about where the money came from. "It's all right there in the reports," Tony said over and over, and Ron had studied the reports. His donors were corporate executives and doctors and defense lawyers and lobbying groups, all dedicated to limiting liability. He knew that when his campaign began. He smelled a conspiracy, but fatigue finally engulfed him. Somewhere in the deep murkiness of a chemical-induced sleep, Ron heard the steady clicking of something he couldn't identify. Click, 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 click. The same sound over and over and very rapid. It was near him. He reached through the darkness and felt Josh's bed. Then he bolted to his feet. In the dim light from the bathroom, he could see his son in the grips of a grotesque seizure. His entire body was shaking violently, his face contorted, his mouth open, his eyes wild. The clicking and rattling got louder. Ron pushed the button to call the nurses. Then he grabbed Josh by the shoulders and tried to settle him. He was astounded at the ferocity of the attack. Two nurses swept in and took charge. A third was right behind them, then a doctor. There was little to be done except stick a depressor in Josh's mouth to prevent an injury to his tongue. When Ron couldn't watch any longer, he backed away into a corner and looked at the surreal image of his badly damaged son, lost in a crowd of helping hands, while the bed still shook and the rails still clicked. The seizure finally relented, and the nurses were soon washing his face with cool water and speaking in childlike voices. Ron eased from the room for another mindless hike through the corridors. The seizures continued off and on for 24 hours, then abruptly stopped. By that time, Ron and Doreen were too weary and frazzled to do anything but stare at their son and pray that he remained still and calm. Other doctors arrived, all grim-faced and uttering incomprehensible words among themselves. More tests were ordered, and Josh was taken away for hours, then brought back. Days passed and blurred together. Time meant nothing. On a Saturday morning, Ron sneaked into his office at the Garten Building. Both clerks were there at his request. There were 12 cases to decide, and Ron had read their brief summaries and recommendations. The clerks had their own little docket prepared and were ready for the roll call. A rape conviction from Rankin County, affirmed with a unanimous court. An election dispute from Bolivar County, affirmed with 7 others. An extremely dull secure transaction brouhaha from Panola County, affirmed with a unanimous court. And so on. With Ron preoccupied and showing little interest in the work, the first 10 cases were disposed of in 20 minutes. "Baker versus Crane Chemical," a clerk said. "What's the buzz?" Ron asked. 4-4 split with everybody throwing knives. Callaghan and company are quite nervous about you. McElwain and his side are curious. Everybody's watching, waiting. They think I've cracked up. No one's sure. They think you're under a great deal of stress, and there's speculation about some great cathartic flip-flop because of what's happened. Let them speculate. I'll wait on Baker and that nursing home case. Are you considering a vote to uphold the verdicts? The other clerk asked. Ron had already learned that most of the court's gossip was created and spread by the network of clerks, all of them. "I don't know," he said. 30 minutes later, he was back at the hospital. Chapter 38. 8 days later, on a rainy Sunday morning, Josh Fisk was loaded into an ambulance for the drive to Brookhaven. Once there, he would be placed in a room at the hospital 5 minutes from home. He would be watched closely for a week or so, then hopefully released. Doreen rode with him in the ambulance. Ron drove to the Garten building and went to his office on the fourth floor. There was no sign of anyone there, which was precisely what he wanted. For the third or fourth time, he read Callaghan's opinion reversing the verdict in Baker versus Crane Chemical. And though he had once agreed with it completely, he now had doubts. It could have been written by Jared Curtin himself. Callaghan found fault with virtually all of Baker's expert testimony. He criticized Judge Harrison for admitting most of it. His sharpest language condemned the expert who linked the carcinogenic byproducts to the actual cancers, calling it speculative at best. He imposed an impossible standard that would require clear proof that the toxins in the Bowmore water caused the cancers that killed Pete and Chad Baker. As always, he caterwauled at the sheer size of the shocking verdict and blamed it on the undue passion created by Baker's attorneys that inflamed the jurors. Ron read again the opinion by McIlwain, and it too sounded much different. It was time to vote, to make his decision, and he simply had no stomach for it. He was tired of the case, tired of the pressure, tired of the anger at being used like a pawn by powerful forces he should have recognized. He was exhausted from Josh's ordeal and just wanted to go home. He had no confidence in his ability to do what was right, and he wasn't sure what that was anymore. He had prayed until he was tired of praying. He had tried to explain his misgivings to Doreen, but she was as distracted and unstable as he was. If he reversed the verdict, he would betray his true feelings. But his feelings were changing, were they not? How could he, as a detached jurist, suddenly swap sides because of his family's tragedy? If he upheld the verdict, he would betray those who had elected him. 53% of the people had voted for Ron Fisk because they believed in his platform. Or did they? Perhaps they had voted for him because he was so well marketed. Would it be fair to all the errands out there for Ron to selfishly change his judicial philosophy because of his own son? He hated these questions. They exhausted him even more. He paced around his office more confused than ever, and he thought of leaving again. Just run, he told himself. But he was tired of running and pacing and talking to the walls. He typed his opinion. I concur and agree with Justice Callaghan, but I do so with grave misgivings. This court, with my complicity and especially because of my presence, has rapidly become a blind protector of those who wish to severely restrict liability in all areas of personal injury law. It is a dangerous course. In the nursing home case, he typed his second opinion. I concur with Justice Albritton and uphold the verdict rendered in the Circuit Court of Webster County. The actions of the nursing home fall far short of the standard of care our laws require. Then he typed a memo to the court that read, For the next 30 days, I will be on leave of absence from the court's business. I am needed at home. The Supreme Court of Mississippi posts its rulings on its website each Thursday at noon. And each Thursday at noon, quite a few lawyers either sat before their computers in nervous anticipation or made sure someone did so for them. Jared Curtin kept an associate on guard. Sterling Bentz watched his smartphone at that precise hour, regardless of where in the world he happened to be. F. Clyde Hardin, still a caveman with technology, sat in the darkness of his locked office, drank his lunch, and waited. Every trial lawyer with a Bowmore case kept watch. The anticipation was shared by a few non-lawyers as well. Tony Zachary and Barry Reinhardt made it a point to be on the phone with each other when the opinions came down. Carl Trudeau counted the minutes each week. In Lower and Mid-Manhattan, dozens of securities analysts monitored the website. Denny Ott had a sandwich with his wife in the office at the church. The parsonage next door did not have a computer. And nowhere was the magical hour more dreaded and anticipated than within the shabby confines of Peyton and Peyton. The entire firm gathered in the pit at the always cluttered work table and had lunch as Sherman stared at his laptop. On the first Thursday in May at 12:15, he announced, "Here it is." Food was shoved aside, the air grew thinner, and breathing became more difficult. Wes refused to look at Mary Grace, and she refused to look at him. Indeed, no one in the room made eye contact with anyone else. "The opinion is written by Justice Arlen Callaghan," Sherman continued. "I'll just skim along here. 5 pages, 10 pages, 15 pages, let's see. A majority opinion that's 21 pages long, joined by Romano, Bateman, Ross, Fisk. Reversed and rendered. Final judgment entered for the defendant, Crane Chemical." Sherman continued, "Romano concurs with 4 pages of his usual drivel. Fisk concurs briefly," a pause as he kept scrolling, "and then a 12-page dissent by McIlwain with all Britain concurring. That's all I need to know. I won't read this piece of shit for at least a month." He stood and left the room. "It's not exactly a surprise," Wes said. No one responded. F. Clyde Hardin wept at his desk. This disaster had been looming for months, but it still crushed him. His one chance to strike it rich was gone, and with it, all of his dreams. He cursed Sterling Bentz and his harebrained class action. He cursed Ron Fisk and the other 4 clowns in his majority. He cursed the blind sheep in Cary County and throughout the rest of South Mississippi who had been hoodwinked into voting against Sheila McCarthy. He fixed another vodka, then cursed and drank and cursed and drank until he passed out with his head on his desk. 7 doors down, Babe took a phone call and got the news. Her coffee shop was soon packed with the Main Street crowd looking for answers and gossip and support. For many, the news was incomprehensible. There would be no cleanup, no recovery, no compensation, no apologies. Crane Chemical was walking free and thumbing its nose at the town and its victims. Denny Ott received a call from Mary Grace. She gave a quick summary and stressed that the litigation was over. They had no viable options. The only avenue left was an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they would, of course, file the obligatory paperwork. But there was no chance that the court would agree to consider such a case. She and Wes would be down in a few days to meet with their clients. Denny and his wife opened the fellowship hall, pulled out some cookies and bottled water, and waited for their people to arrive for consoling. Late in the afternoon, Mary Grace walked into Wes's office and closed the door. She had 2 sheets of paper, and she handed one to him. It was a letter to their Bowmore clients. "Take a look," she said, and sat down to read it herself. It read, "Dear client, today the Supreme Court of Mississippi ruled in favor of Crane Chemical. Jeanette Baker's appeal was reversed and rendered, which means that it cannot be retried or refiled. We intend to ask the court for a rehearing, which is customary, but also a waste of time. We will also appeal her case to the U.S. Supreme Court, but this, too, is a mere formality. That court rarely considers state court cases such as this. Today's ruling, and we will send you a full copy next week, makes it impossible to proceed with your case against Crane. The court applied a standard of proof that makes it impossible to pin liability on the company, and it's painfully obvious what would happen to another verdict when presented to the same court. Words cannot express our disappointment and frustration. We have fought this battle for 5 years against enormous odds, and we have lost in many ways. But our losses are nothing compared to yours. We will continue to think of you, pray for you, and talk to you whenever you need us. We have been honored by your trust. God bless you.
Very nice, Wes said. Let's get them in the mail.
Crane Chemical roared to life in the afternoon's trading. It gained $4.75 a share and closed at $38.50. Mr. Trudeau had now regained the billion he lost, and more was on the way. He gathered Bobby Ratzlaff, Felix Bard, and two other confidants in his office for a little party. They sipped Cristal champagne, smoked Cuban cigars, and congratulated themselves on their stunning turnaround. They now considered Carl a true genius, a visionary. Even in the darkest days, he never wavered. His mantra had been, "Buy the stock, buy the stock." He reminded Bobby of his promise on the day of the verdict. Not one penny of his hard-earned profits would ever be handed over to those ignorant people and their slimy lawyers. Chapter 39. The guests ranged from hardcore Wall Street types like Carl himself, all the way down to Brianna's hair colorist and two semi-employed Broadway actors. There were bankers with their aging, though nicely sculpted wives, and moguls with their superbly starved trophies. There were Trudeau Group executives who would rather have been anywhere else, and struggling painters from the MUAB crowd who were thrilled at the rare chance to mingle with the jet set. There were a few models, number 388 on the Forbes 400 list, a running back who played for the Jets, a reporter from the Times along with a photographer to record it all, and a reporter from the Journal who would report none of it but didn't want to miss the party. About 100 guests all in all, a very rich crowd. But no one at the party had ever seen a yacht like the Brianna. It was docked on the Hudson at the Chelsea Piers, and the only vessel larger at that moment was a mothballed aircraft carrier a quarter of a mile to the north. In the rarefied world of obscenely expensive boating, the Brianna was classified as a mega yacht, which was larger than a super yacht, but not in the same league as a giga yacht. The latter, so far, had been the exclusive domain of a handful of software zillionaires, Saudi princes, and Russian oil thugs. The invitation read, "Please join Mr. and Mrs. Carl Trudeau on the maiden voyage of their mega yacht Brianna on Wednesday, May 26th at 6 p.m. at Pier 60. It was 192 feet long, which ranked it number 21 on the list of the largest yachts registered in America. Carl paid $60 million for it 2 weeks after Ron Fisk was elected, then spent another $15 million on renovations, upgrades, and toys. Now it was time to show it off and to display one of the more dramatic comebacks in recent corporate history. The crew of 18 gave tours as the guests arrived and took their glasses of champagne. With four decks above water, the ship could comfortably accommodate 30 pampered friends for a month at sea. Not that Carl ever intended to have that many people living so close to him. Those lucky enough to be chosen for an extended cruise would have access to a gym with a trainer, a spa with a masseuse, six jacuzzis, and a chef on call around the clock. They would dine at one of four tables scattered throughout the boat, the smallest with 10 seats and the largest with 40. When they felt like playing, there was scuba gear, clear-bottom kayaks, a 30-foot catamaran, jet skis, and fishing gear. And of course, no mega yacht is complete without a helicopter. Other luxuries included a movie theater, 4 fireplaces, a sky lounge, heated tile floors in the bathrooms, a private pool for nude sunbathing, and miles of mahogany and brass and Italian marble. The Trudeaus' stateroom was larger than their bedroom back on land, and in the formal dining room on the 3rd level, Carl had finally found the permanent place for abused Imelda. Never again would she greet him in the foyer of his penthouse after a hard day at the office. As a string quartet played on the main deck, the Brianna shoved off and turned south on the Hudson. It was dusk, a beautiful sunset, and the view of Lower Manhattan from the river was breathtaking. The city shook with its frenetic energy, which was fascinating to watch from the deck of such a fine boat. The champagne and caviar also helped the view. Those on ferries and smaller vessels couldn't help but gawk as Brianna moved by, her twin 2,000-horsepower Caterpillar diesels churning a quiet wake. A small army of black-tied waiters moved deftly about the decks, hauling drinks on silver trays and finger food too pretty to eat. Carl ignored most of his guests and spent his time with those he controlled one way or another. Brianna was the perfect hostess, gliding from group to group, kissing all the men and all the women, making sure everyone got the chance to see her. The captain circled wide so the guests could have a nice view of Ellis Island and the Statue of Liberty, then turned north in the direction of the Battery at the southern tip of Manhattan. It was dark now, and the rows of skyscrapers lit up the financial district. Under the Brooklyn Bridge, under the Manhattan Bridge, under the Williamsburg Bridge, the Brianna sailed up the East River in all its majesty. The string quartet retired, and the best of Billy Joel boomed through the ship's elaborate sound system. Dancing erupted on the 2nd-level deck. Someone got shoved into a pool, others followed, and clothing soon became optional. It was the younger crowd. As per Carl's instructions, the captain turned around at the United Nations building and increased speed, though it was not noticed. Carl at that moment was giving an interview in his sweeping office on the 3rd deck. At precisely 10:30, on schedule, the Brianna docked at Pier 60, and the guests began their slow departures. Mr. and Mrs. Trudeau saw them off, hugging, kissing, waving, wishing they would all hurry along now. A midnight dinner was waiting. 14 remained behind, 7 lucky couples who would cruise south to Palm Beach for a few days. They changed into more casual clothing and met in the formal dining room for yet another drink while the chef finalized the first course. Carl whispered to the first mate that it was now time to leave, and 15 minutes later, the Brianna pushed off again from Pier 60. While the guests were being charmed by his wife, he excused himself for a few minutes. He climbed the steps to the 4th level, and on a small elevated deck, found his favorite spot on this fabulous new toy of his. It was an observation post, the ship's highest point above the water. As the cool wind blew his hair, he gripped the brass railing and stared at the mammoth towers in the financial district. He caught a glimpse of his building and his office 45 floors up. Everything was up. Crane common stock was just under $50 a share. Its earnings were through the roof. His net worth was over $3 billion and rising steadily. Some of those idiots out there had been laughing 18 months earlier. Crane is finished. Trudeau is a fool. How can a man lose $1 billion in one day? They howled. Where was their laughter now? Where were all those experts now? The great Carl Trudeau had outfoxed them again. He had cleaned up the Bowmore mess and saved his company. He had driven its stock into the ground, bought it cheap at a fire sale, and now owned virtually all of it. It was making him even richer. He was destined to move up the Forbes 400 list. And as Carl sailed along the Hudson at the very top of his extraordinary ship and gazed with smug satisfaction at the gleaming towers packed around Wall Street, he admitted to himself that nothing else mattered. Now that he had $3 billion, he really wanted six. Author's note. I am compelled to defend my native state, and do so with this flurry of disclaimers. All characters herein are purely fictional. Any similarity to a real person is coincidental. There is no Carey County, no town of Bowmore, no Crane Chemical, and no product such as Pillamar 5. Bichloronilene, Achlar, and Cartilix do not exist, as far as I know. The Mississippi Supreme Court has 9 elected members, none of whom were used as models or inspirations for anyone mentioned or described in the preceding program. None of the organizations, associations, groups, nonprofits, think tanks, churches, casinos, or corporations are real. I just made them up. Some of the towns and cities can be found on a map, others cannot. The campaign is a figment of my imagination. The lawsuit is borrowed from several actual cases. A few of the buildings really do exist, but I'm not altogether sure which ones. In another life, I served as a member of the Mississippi House of Representatives, and in that capacity had a role in making laws. In this book, some of those laws have been amended, modified, ignored, and even outright butchered. Writing fiction sometimes requires this. A few of the laws, especially those dealing with casino gambling, survive without tampering on my part. Now that I have impugned my own work, I must say that there is a lot of truth in this story. As long as private money is allowed in judicial elections, we will see competing interests fight for seats on the bench. The issues are fairly common. Most of the warring factions are adequately described. The tactics are all too familiar. The results are not far off the mark. As always, I leaned on others for advice and expertise. Thanks to Mark Lee, Jim Craig, Neil Cassell, Bobby Moak, David Gernert, Mike Ratliff, Ty, Bert Coley, and John Sherman. Stephen Rubin published this book, Doubleday's 20th, and the gang there, John Fontana, Rebecca Holland, John Pitts, Kathy Traeger, Allison Rich, and Suzanne Hertz, again made it happen. And thanks to Renee for her usual patience and abundance of editorial comments. John Grisham, October 1st, 2007. This is Michael Beck. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Appeal by John Grisham. This program was directed by David Rapkin. Executive producers Dan Zitt and Orly Moskowitz. This program was edited at John Marshall Sound. Text copyright 2008 by Belfry Holdings, Inc. Production copyright 2008, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.